Rogan or Alex Rogan so badly that he'd concocted this elaborate, delusional fantasy in an attempt to make it so. And that, I told myself, was probably the exact same sort of starry-eyed wanderlust that had triggered my glaive fighter hallucination. Maybe the whole incident had even been inspired by the contents of the very journal I now held in my hands. Maybe the memory of my father's conspiracy theory had been sitting up in a forgotten corner of my brain all these years, like a discarded crate of dynamite sticks, sweating drops of nitroglycerin onto my subconscious. I took a deep breath and exhaled it slowly, comforted by my half-assed self-diagnosis. Nothing but a mild flare-up of inherited nuttiness, brought on by my lifelong dead dad fixation and somewhat related self-instituted overexposure to science fiction. And I had been spending way too much time playing video games lately, especially Armada. I played it every night and all day on the weekends. I'd even ditched school a few times to play elite missions on servers in Asia that were scheduled in the middle of the day over here. Clearly, I had been overdoing it for some time now. But that was easy enough to remedy. I would just go cold turkey for a while to clear my head. Sitting there in the dusty attic, I made a silent vow to quit playing Armada entirely for 2 full weeks. Starting right after the elite mission scheduled later that night, of course. Bailing on that wasn't even really an option. Elite missions only rolled out a few times a year, and they usually revealed new plot developments in the game's ongoing storyline. In fact, I had spent the past week practicing and preparing for tonight's mission, playing Armada even more than I normally did. I'd probably been seeing glaive fighters in my sleep. No wonder I was seeing them when I was awake now, too. I just needed to cut myself off, to take a break. Then, everything would be fine. I would be fine. I was still repeating those words to myself, like a mantra, when my phone buzzed a reminder at me. Shit. I'd spent so long up here screwing around that I'd made myself late for work. I got to my feet and tossed my father's journal back into its cardboard coffin. Enough was enough. The time had come for me to stop living in the past. My father's past, especially. A lot of his old stuff had migrated downstairs to my bedroom. An embarrassing amount, I now realized. My room was practically a shrine to his memory. It was high time I grew up and moved some, if not all, of that crap back up here, where I'd found it, where it belonged. I'd get started on that tonight, I told myself, as I shut the attic door behind me. 3. When I pulled into the half-deserted strip mall where the base was located, I parked a few spots away from my boss Ray's gas-guzzling pride and joy, a red 1964 Ford Galaxy with a faded bumper sticker that read, "Starship Captains Do It on Impulse." As usual, the rest of the customer parking lot was empty, except for a small cluster of cars in front of Thai, the generically named Thai food restaurant at the other end of the strip mall, where Ray and I ordered copious amounts of takeout. We'd nicknamed the place Thai Fighter because the capital H on their sign had a circular bulge at its center that made the letter resemble an Imperial fighter with twin ion engines. The sign mounted over the entrance of Starbase Ace was a bit fancier. Ray had designed it to look like a real starbase was bursting out of the building's brick facade. It had cost him a fortune, but it did look cool as hell. As I pushed through the front door, the electronic chime Ray had rigged up to it activated, playing a sliding door sound effect from the original Star Trek TV series, making it sound like I was walking onto the bridge of the Enterprise. It still made me smile every time I arrived at work, even today. As I walked into the store, a pair of toy laser turrets mounted on the ceiling swiveled around to track me, activated by their primitive motion sensors. Ray had taped a sign to the wall beside them that read, "Warning, anyone caught shoplifting will be vaporized by our turbo lasers." Ray was in his usual spot behind the counter, hunched over Big Bootay, his ancient overclocked gaming PC. His left hand danced across its keyboard while he clicked the mouse with his right. Zack is back for the attack, Ray bellowed, keeping his eyes on the game. How is school, my man? Uneventful, I lied, joining him behind the counter. How's business today?
Nice and slow, just like we like it, he said. Dost thou care for a Funyun?
He proffered a giant bag of these simulated onion rings, and I took one to be polite. Ray seemed to subsist primarily on a diet of high-fructose junk food and old video games. It was hard not to love the guy. Back before I was old enough to drive, I used to ride my bike over to Starbase Ace every day after school, just to bullshit about old video games with Ray and kill time until my mom got off work at the hospital. Either he recognized me as a kindred spirit, or he just got tired of my chronic latchkey kid loitering and eventually offered me a job. I was overjoyed, even before I discovered that my new position as assistant sales clerk involved about 10% actual work and about 90% hanging out with Ray while we played video games, cracked jokes, and ate junk food on the clock. Ray once told me that he operated Starbase Ace for kicks. After making a boatload of dough on tech stocks during the dot-com boom, he now wanted to enjoy his early retirement at the helm of his own private nerd lair, where he got to spend all day playing and talking about video games with his like-minded clientele. He was always saying he didn't give a damn if the store ever turned a profit, which was good because it rarely did. Ray paid way too much for the used games we bought, and then immediately priced them for less than he'd just paid for them. He put everything on sale all the time. He sold consoles, controllers, and hardware at no markup to, as he put it, foster customer loyalty and promote the gaming industry. Ray was also terrible at customer service. He made people wait at the register if he was in the middle of playing a game. He also loved to talk shit about people's game selections while he was ringing them up, if he thought they were buying a lame or easy title, and I'd seen him drive both children and adults out of the store with his opinions on everything from cheat codes to crop circles. He didn't seem to care if his rude behavior drove him out of business. I did, though, which made for a strange employee-employer relationship, since I was usually the one who had to scold him for not being more polite to our customers. I fished my Starbase Ace name tag out of a drawer and pinned it on. A few years ago, as a joke, Ray had put his nickname for me on there, so now it read, "Hello, my name is Zack Attack." He didn't know that Zack Attack was also the name my peers had saddled me with after the incident back in junior high. I stood there stalling for a few more minutes, then forced myself to walk over to Smallberries, our second enormous sales PC. I clicked its mouse a few times and opened a search engine. I glanced at Ray to make sure he wasn't looking my way, then typed in the words Beaverton, Oregon, UFO, and Flying Saucer. The only hits that came back were references to Flying Saucer Pizza, a local restaurant. There were no recent UFO sightings mentioned on the local TV station or newspaper websites. If anyone else had seen the same ship I had, they still hadn't reported it. Or maybe there had been a report, but no one had taken it seriously? I sighed and closed the browser window, then glanced back over at Ray. If there was anyone I could have told about the Glaive Fighter, it was him. Ray seemed to believe that everything happening in the world was somehow connected to Roswell, Area 51, or Hangar 18. He'd told me on numerous occasions that he believed aliens had already made first contact with humanity decades ago, and that our leaders were still covering it up all these years later because the sheeple of Earth weren't ready to hear the truth yet. But UFO cover-ups and alien abductions were one thing. Seeing a fictional alien spacecraft from a best-selling video game series buzzing your town made even the craziest Roswell conspiracy theories seem sane by comparison. Besides, how was I supposed to walk over to Ray and tell him with a straight face that I'd seen a Sobra Kai fighter buzzing our town when he was, at that very moment, doing battle with that very same fictional alien race? I walked over to get a better view of his huge monitor. Ray was playing the same video game he'd been playing pretty much non-stop for the past few years. Terra Firma, a wildly popular first-person shooter published by Chaos Terrain, the same developer behind Armada. Both games shared the same near-future alien invasion storyline, in which Earth was being attacked by the Sobrakai, a race of ill-tempered, anthropomorphic, squid-like creatures from Tau Ceti V, who were hell-bent on exterminating all of humanity for one of the usual bullshit reasons. They wanted our sweet-ass M-class planet, and sharing shit just wasn't in their cephalopod nature. Like nearly every race of evil alien invaders in the history of science fiction, the Sobrakai were somehow technologically advanced enough to construct huge warships capable of crossing interstellar space, and yet still not smart enough to terraform a lifeless world to suit their needs, instead of going through the huge hassle of trying to conquer one that was already inhabited, especially one inhabited by billions of nuke-wielding apes who generally don't cotton to strangers being on their land. No, the Sobrakai just had to have Earth for some reason, and they were determined to kill all humans before they took possession. Luckily for us, like so many made-up evil alien invaders before them, the Sobrakai also seemed intent on exterminating us as slowly and inefficiently as possible. Instead of just wiping out humanity with a meteor or a killer virus or a few old-fashioned long-range nuclear weapons, the squids had opted to wage a prolonged World War II-style air and ground war against us, while somehow allowing all of their advanced weapons, propulsion, and communications technology to fall into their primitive enemy's hands. In both Armada and Terra Firma, you played a human recruit in the Earth Defense Alliance, tasked with using a variety of ground-based combat drones to fight off the invasion. Each drone in the EDA's arsenal was designed to serve as a direct match for a similar type of drone used by the alien enemy. Terra Firma focused on humanity's ground war against the Sobrakai after their drones had reached Earth. Armada was an aerospace combat sim released the following year, allowing players to remotely control humanity's global stockpile of defense drones and use them to battle the Sobrakai invaders out in space and over the besieged cities of Earth. Since their release, Terra Firma and Armada had become two of the most popular multiplayer action games in the world. I'd played TF religiously when it came out, until Chaos Terrain released Armada the following year, and then it had become my primary video game obsession. I still played Terra Firma with Cruz and Deal a few times a week, usually in return for them agreeing to play an Armada mission with me. Ray also frequently coerced me into playing TF with him here at work, so my infantry drone skills were still sharp. This was essential because in Terra Firma, the size and power of the drones you were allowed to control during each mission was based on your overall combat skill rating. Newbie players were only authorized to operate the smallest and cheapest combat drones in the EDA's arsenal. Once you increased in rank and skill, you were allowed to pilot increasingly bigger and more advanced drones. Spartan hover tanks, Nautiloid attack submarines, Sentinels, 10-foot-tall super aethids with more firepower, and the EDA's largest and most impressive weapon, the Titan War Mech, a giant humanoid robot that looked like something out of an old Japanese anime. Ray happened to be controlling a war mech at that very moment, and he was in trouble. I watched as a horde of alien spider fighters closed in on him. His mech finally succumbed to the incoming barrage of laser fire and toppled backward into a large tenement building, demolishing it. He and I both winced, and Terra Firma players got penalized for all of the property damage caused by their drones in combat, intentional or otherwise. Although the game's backstory embraced a lot of tired alien invasion tropes, it subverted many of them too. For example, the Sobrakai weren't actually invading Earth in person. They were using drones to do it. And humanity had constructed its own stockpile of drones to repel them. So all of the aerospace fighters, mechs, tanks, subs, and ground troops used by both sides were remotely controlled war machines, each one operated by an alien or human who was physically located somewhere far from the battlefield. From a purely tactical standpoint, using drones made a hell of a lot more sense than using manned or aliened ships and vehicles to wage an interplanetary war. Why risk the lives of your best pilots by sending them into combat? Now whenever I watched a Star Wars film, I found myself wondering how the Empire had the technology to make long-distance holographic phone calls between planets light years apart and yet no one had figured out how to make a remote-controlled TIE fighter or X-Wing yet.
A warning message flashed on Ray's HUD. Your drone has been destroyed.
Then his display went dark for a second before a new message flashed on his HUD, informing him that he had just been given control of a new drone. But, since all of his unit's larger drones and tanks had already been destroyed, Ray was forced to take control of the only thing they had left, an AATHID, Armored Tactical Humanoid Infantry Drone. From the neck down, an AATHID looked similar to the original Terminator after all of Arnie's cyborg flesh got burned away, leaving only its armored chrome skeleton underneath. But in place of a human-shaped head, each AATHID had a stereoscopic camera encased inside an armored acrylic dome, giving it a vaguely insect-like appearance. Every AATHID was armed with a Gauss minigun mounted on each forearm, a pair of shoulder-mounted missile launchers, and a laser cannon embedded in its chest plate. I watched over Ray's shoulder as he used his AATHID's twin miniguns to mow down an onslaught of Sobrakai spider fighters, eight-legged anti-personnel robots that were attacking him on the roof of a burning tenement building, somewhere near the center of the besieged city he was helping defend. He was bobbing his head in time to his favorite TF battle soundtrack song, Vital Signs by Rush. Ray claimed that its unique time signature matched up perfectly with the alien spider fighter drone's erratic swarming patterns, making it easier for him to anticipate their movements and rate of attack. He also claimed that each of the other songs on Rush's Moving Pictures album was perfect for battling a different Sobrakai drone. Personally, I'd always assumed this was just an excuse he'd concocted for playing that same album on a continuous loop day after day. On Ray's monitor, dozens of Sobrakai troop ships were descending from the sky. These massive gunmetal-gray octahedrons were what the enemy used to deploy their ground forces once they reached Earth's orbit. Each one had automated sentry guns mounted all over its heavily armored hull, which was nearly invulnerable to laser fire. Of course, in typical video game fashion, these ships had been engineered with a glaring weak spot. Their engines were unshielded and vulnerable to attack, a fact I knew well from playing Armada. When one of these diamond-shaped troop ships made landfall, it would impact with enough velocity to bury its lower half into the surface, like a giant spike. Then the pyramid-shaped top half would open like an enormous four-petaled metal flower, and the thousands of Sobrakai drones packed inside it would pour out, like an army of newborn insects bursting from a broken egg sac, intent on devouring everything in sight. In the distance, a swarm of Sobrakai glaive fighters streaked across the sky, banking in unison to change course, like a school of piranha in search of prey. Viewed from above, the glaive's symmetrical fuselage resembled the blade of a double-headed axe. But seen edge-on, its profile distinctly resembled that of a flying saucer from an old sci-fi film, a detail that had worked its way into my earlier hallucination. I'd destroyed countless glaive fighters during the 3 years I'd been playing Armada. Until now, I'd never found them especially frightening or ominous. But today, just seeing the background animations on Ray's screen filled me with a sense of dread, as if the ships really were somehow a threat to everything I held dear and not a harmless collection of textured polygons rendered on a computer display. Ray power-leaped his AATHID off of the burning rooftop and onto the back of a Sobrakai Basilisk, a reptilian-looking robot tank with laser cannons for eyes. Ray power-jumped into the air again, spinning his AATHID around 180 degrees just before he brought the huge metal basilisk down with a single, well-placed missile shot to its segmented abdomen. It exploded beneath him in a huge orange fireball, and Ray had to fire his AATHID's jump jets again to land clear of it.
Bravo, Sergeant, I said, using his rank in the fictional Earth Defense Alliance. Thank you, Lieutenant, he replied. I'm doing my best, sir.
He grinned and raised his right hand off of his mouth long enough to snap me a salute before refocusing on the battle. According to the readouts on his HUD, his squadron had already lost all six of their hover tanks and both of their Titans. They only had seven AATHIDs left in reserve, and the pulsing icons on his tactical map indicated these were stored inside a nearby EDA weapons cache that was already under attack by a swarm of spider fighters. Ray's squadron was fighting a losing battle at this point. The city would fall to the Sobrakai any minute now. But as usual, Ray kept on fighting, even in the face of certain defeat. It was one of his most endearing qualities. Ray was, by far, the best Terra Firma player I'd ever seen in person. A few months ago, he'd finally managed to earn membership in the 30 Dozen, an elite clan of the best 360 players in the game. Since then, I'd seen him logged on to Terra Firma's servers every day, playing one high-level mission after another. And since he wasn't burdened with distractions like school or homework, Ray could devote his every waking moment to the game, so he logged more combat time than me, Cruz, and Deal all put together. "Son of a bitch!" Ray shouted, hitting the side of his monitor. I glanced over and saw that the Sobrakai were currently overrunning the surviving members of his squadron and exterminating the last of their drones. A few seconds after Ray's last reserve aethid was crushed between a spider fighter's vice-like mandibles, the words, "Mission failed," flashed on his display, and then he was treated to a cutscene animation of the Sobrakai's forces destroying downtown Newark. "Oh well," he muttered, shoving another mouthful of Funyuns into his face as he pondered the city's smoking ruins. "At least it's only Newark, right? No big loss." He chuckled to himself as he wiped simulated onion dust off his fingers and onto the legs of his jeans. Then he gave me an excited grin. "Hey, guess what came in today?" he asked. Then he produced a large box from underneath the counter and set it in front of me. If I'd been a cartoon character, my eyes would have bulged out of their sockets. It was a brand new Armada Interceptor Flight Control System, the most advanced and expensive video game controller ever made.
"No way," I whispered, examining the photos and stats printed on its glossy black box. "I thought these things weren't supposed to hit the market until next month."
"Looks like Chaos Terrain decided to ship them early," he said, rubbing his hands together excitedly. "Want to unbox this bad boy?" I nodded my head vigorously, and Ray grabbed a packing knife. He cut the box open and then instructed me to hold on to its sides as he pulled out the styrofoam cube housing the controller's various components. A few seconds later, everything was freed from the packaging and laid out on the glass countertop in front of us. The Armada Interceptor Flight Control System, IFCS, contained an interceptor pilot helmet, incorporating a set of built-in VR goggles, noise-canceling headphones, and a retractable microphone, and a two-piece HOTUS, hands-on throttle and stick, rig, comprised of an all-metal force-feedback flight stick and a separate dual-throttle controller with a built-in weapons control panel. The stick, throttle, and weapons panel all bristled with ergonomic buttons, triggers, indicators, mode selectors, rotary dials, and eight-way hat studs, each of which could be configured to give you total control of your Armada Interceptor's flight, navigation, and weapons systems. "You like it, Zach?" Ray asked after watching me drool over it for a while. "Ray, I want to marry this thing." "We've got over a dozen more back in the stockroom," he said. "Maybe we can build a display pyramid out of them or something." I picked up the helmet and hefted it, impressed by its weight and detail. It looked and felt like a real fighter pilot helmet, and its Oculus Rift components were state-of-the-art. I had a half-decent VR headset at home that Ray had gifted me, but it was a few years old, and the display resolution had increased drastically since then.
"These new helmets can read your thoughts, too," Ray joked. "But you have to think in Russian." I laughed and set the helmet back on the counter, resisting the urge to try it on.
Then I reached out and rested my left hand on the throttle controller while I wrapped my right hand around the cold metal of the attached flight stick. Both seemed like a perfect fit, as if they'd been machined to match my hands. I'd been playing Armada for years, and the whole time I'd been using a cheap plastic flight stick and throttle controller. I'd had no idea what I'd been missing. I'd coveted an IFCS ever since I heard they were coming out on the Armada forums, but the price tag was somewhere north of $500. Even with my 10% employee discount, that was still way too rich for my blood. I reluctantly slid my hands off the controllers and shoved them into my pockets. If I start saving up now, I might be able to afford one by the end of the summer, I muttered. That is, if my crap-mobile doesn't break down again. Ray mimed playing a violin. Then he smiled and slid the helmet across the counter to me. You can have this one, he said. Consider it an early graduation gift. He elbowed me playfully. You are going to graduate, right?
No way,
I said, staring at the controller in disbelief. Then I looked up at Ray. I mean, yes, I'll graduate, but...
You're not kidding? I can have this one? For reals?
Ray nodded solemnly. For reals. I felt like hugging him, so I did, throwing my arms around his thick midsection in a fierce embrace. He laughed uncomfortably and patted me on the back until I finally let go of him. I'm only doing it because it's good for the war effort, he said, straightening his flannel shirt and then ruffling my hair in retaliation. Having your own flight control system might make you an even better interceptor pilot, if that's even possible.
Ray, this is way too generous, I said. Thank you.
Don't mention it, kid.
Although I'd been worrying for years that Ray's runaway altruism would drive him bankrupt and that I'd be forced to go find a real job somewhere, it didn't stop me from accepting his latest extravagant gift.
Want to head back to the war room and give it a spin?
He motioned to the small, cramped back room where dozens of linked PCs and gaming consoles were set up. Customers rented the war room out for LAN parties and clan events.
You could work out the kinks before that big elite mission later tonight.
No thanks, I said. I think I'll just wait and try it out then on my home setup. Because I might flip out or start foaming at the mouth the next time I see a glaive fighter coming at me, and I'd rather be alone in my bedroom if and when it happens. He cocked an eyebrow at me. What's wrong with you? He said. You sick? I looked away. No, I'm fine, I replied. Why?
Your boss just offered you a chance to play your favorite video game at work on the clock and you turn it down?
He reached out to touch my forehead.
You got a brain fever or something, kid?
I laughed uneasily and shook my head.
No, it's just, I recently vowed to stop goofing off so much here at work, regardless of how much you encourage me to.
Why in the hell would you do that?
It's all part of my master plan, I said, to show you how responsible and reliable I've become so you'll hire me on as a full-time employee after I graduate.
He shot me the same perturbed look he always seemed to give me whenever I brought up this subject.
Zach, you can work here for as long as we manage to stay in business, he said. Honestly, though, you have to know you're destined for much bigger things, right?
Thanks, Ray, I said, struggling not to roll my eyes. If today was any indication, the only thing I was destined for was a straitjacket. Maybe a padded helmet, too.
You cannot escape your destiny, he said in his best Obi-Wan.
Then he collapsed back onto his stool and fired up another Terra Firma mission with a click of his mouse. Chaos Terrain manufactured a wide variety of Terra Firma controllers, including the best-selling Titan control system, a dual flight stick rig that we sold right here in the store. But Ray never played with anything but a keyboard and mouse. He also still preferred a two-dimensional computer monitor to VR goggles, which he claimed gave him vertigo. Like a lot of gamers his age, Ray was set in his ways. In spite of what I'd just said to him, I walked back over to Smallberries and clicked the Terra Firma icon on its desktop. The game's opening cutscene began, and I almost hit skip intro out of habit, but then I let it play, rewatching it for the first time in years. The intro's somber opening voiceover, performed by Morgan Freeman, killing it like always, briefly laid out the game's basic storyline. It was set sometime in the mid-21st century, roughly 10 years after Earth was invaded by the Sobrakai, an aquatic race hailing from the Tau Ceti star system, a popular point of origin for aliens since the dawn of sci-fi due to its close proximity to Earth. The Sobrakai somewhat resembled the giant squids of Earth, but with an added mane of spiked tentacles and a vertical shark-like mouth ringed by 6 soulless black eyes. The game's intro segued into a video transmission the invaders had sent to humanity on the day of their arrival, containing a threatening message from the Sobrakai overlord, whose Weta designers had gone way too Geiger, in my humble opinion. The gray, translucent-skinned creature was shown floating in its dark underwater lair, its tentacles splayed out behind it, addressing the camera in its grating native language, which sounded sort of like a whale song if the whale in question was into death metal. Thankfully, someone turned on the English subtitles just before the overlord began to make his evil alien species somewhat cliched intentions known.
"We are the Sobrakai," it said. "And we declare your pitiful species to be unworthy of survival. You shall therefore be eradicated."
There was more to the overlord's message, but I hit the spacebar to skip over it. I remembered the highlights. These malevolent, unfeeling inkfish had traveled 12 light years across interstellar space to wipe out humanity and then knock down all of our Pizza Huts so that they could seize our rare blue jewel as a world of their own. It was my mission to use my baller video game skills to stop them. Boo-yah. Press fire to continue. The whole convoluted backstory behind humanity's ongoing war with the Sobrakai was available online, but gamers had to piece it together by digging through an elaborate network of Earth Defense Alliance websites, an alternate reality game element meant to help players immerse themselves in the game's narrative. According to the information buried on those sites, at some point during the onset of the Sobrakai invasion a decade ago, the EDA had somehow managed to capture one of the aliens' ships undamaged, and then they had reverse-engineered all of its incredibly advanced weaponry, communication, life support, and propulsion technology, seemingly overnight, and then used it to construct a massive global arsenal of combat drones that were capable of going toe-to-toe with the Sobrakai. Of course, the developers never bothered to explain how the EDA's scientists managed to accomplish these amazing feats in such a short time span while fending off constant attacks from the Sobrakai's vastly superior technology. But the way I saw it, if you were willing to suspend your disbelief enough to believe that a race of anthropomorphic extraterrestrial squids from Tau Ceti had been using an armada of remote-controlled robots to wage war on humanity for the past decade, it was pretty silly to nitpick over plot holes and scientific inaccuracies, especially if they justified evil alien overlords and dogfighting in space. I closed the Terra Firma client and opened a web browser. Then I pulled up Chaos Terrain's website. I clicked through to their website's About Us page and scanned it. As a longtime CT superfan, I already knew quite a lot about the company's history. It had been founded back in 2010 by a Bay Area video game developer named Finn Arbogast, who quit a lucrative job working on the Battlefield series for Electronic Arts to venture out on his own. He founded Chaos Terrain with the lofty goal of creating the next generation of multiplayer VR games. Arbogast had then assembled a dream team of creative consultants and contractors to help make his bold claim a reality, luring some of the video game industry's brightest stars away from their own companies and projects with the sole promise of collaborating on his groundbreaking new MMOs. That was how gaming legends like Chris Roberts, Richard Garriott, Hidetaka Miyazaki, Gabe Newell, and Shigeru Miyamoto had all wound up as consultants on both Terra Firma and Armada, along with several big Hollywood filmmakers, including James Cameron, who had contributed to the EDA's realistic ship and mech designs, and Peter Jackson, whose Weta workshop had rendered all of the in-game cinematics. Chaos Terrain had created its own custom games engine for both Terra Firma and Armada, using many of the same programmers who had worked on previous combat simulation games like Battlefield, Call of Duty, and Modern Warfare, and on existing aerial and space combat simulators like Star Citizen, Elite Dangerous, and EVE Online. This plagiaristic, Frankenstein-like development strategy proved wildly successful. Terra Firma and Armada were two of the best-selling multiplayer video games in the world, and with good reason. Their stripped-down arcade-style gameplay made both titles easy to learn and fun for casual players, but they were also scalable and dynamic enough to be challenging for everyday players like myself. Both games also had killer production values, and they could be played on any modern gaming platform, including smartphones and tablets. Best of all, the games weren't overpriced like most MMOs. Sure, Chaos Terrain charged a low monthly subscription fee to play both Terra Firma and Armada, but once you got good enough to achieve the rank of officer in either game, CT waived your monthly fee and you played for free from then on. And they didn't use in-game microtransactions to milk players for extra revenue either. I closed the window and stared at the icons on the desktop, trying to sort out my thoughts. Until today, it had never occurred to me to make a connection between the alien invasion plotline of Chaos Terrain's games and the conspiracy theory outlined in my father's notebook. There were hundreds of alien invasion-themed movies, shows, books, and video games released every year, and Armada was just one of them. Besides, the game had only been out for a few years, so how could it possibly be connected to the stuff my father had written in his notebook decades ago? On the other hand, if the government really did want to train average citizens to operate drones in combat, then multiplayer combat games like Armada and Terra Firma would be exactly the sort of games you'd create to do it. When the Star Trek door chime sounded a few minutes later, and a gaggle of semi-regulars from the nearby junior high filed into the store, I shoved my new helmet, throttle, and flight stick controllers back into their box and stowed it under the counter before any of the prepubescent hooligans could lay their covetous eyes upon it. "Welcome to Starbase Ace, where the game is never over," I said, reciting the store's canned greeting with as much enthusiasm as I could muster. "How may I help you, young gentlemen, this evening?" Four. When I got back home, my mother's car was parked in the driveway. This was a pleasant surprise, because she'd had to work a lot of overtime at the hospital this past year, and most nights she didn't get home until I'd already crashed. But knowing she was home also put me on edge, because she'd always been able to tell when something was bothering me. When I was younger, I was convinced she possessed some sort of mutant maternal telepathy that allowed her to read my mind, especially when there was crazy shit going on inside it. I found my mother stretched out on the living room sofa, with Muffet curled up at her feet, watching the latest episode of Doctor Who, one of her many televised addictions. Neither of them heard me come in, so I set my Armada controller box on the stairs and then just stood there for a moment, watching my mother watch her show. Pamela Lightman, née Crandall, was the coolest woman I'd ever met, as well as the toughest. She reminded me a lot of Sarah Connor or Ellen Ripley. Sure, she might have a few issues, but she was also the kind of single mom who would strap on heavy artillery and mow down killer cyborgs if that was what it took to protect her offspring. My mother was also ridiculously beautiful. I know people are supposed to say things like that about their mothers, but in my case, it happened to be a fact. Few young men know the Oedipal torment of growing up with an insanely hot, perpetually single mom, watching men constantly flip out over her looks before they'd even bothered to get to know her, had made me faintly disgusted by my own gender, as if I didn't already have enough psychological baggage strapped to my luggage rack. Raising me all by herself had been difficult for my mother in lots of ways that probably weren't obvious to most people. For one thing, she'd done it without any assistance from her own parents. She'd lost her own father to cancer when she was still in grade school, and then her ultra-religious mother had disowned her for getting knocked up while she was still a senior in high school, and then marrying the no-good Nintendo nerd who defiled her. My mom had told me that her mother only tried to reconcile with her once, a few months after my father died. It didn't go well. She'd made the mistake of telling my mom his death was a blessing in disguise, because it meant now she could find herself a respectable husband, one with some prospects. After that, my mom had disowned her. I secretly worried that one of the toughest things for my mother was the simple necessity of being forced to look at my face every day. I looked just like my father, and so far the similarity had only seemed to increase as I got older. Now, I was nearing the age he'd been at the time of his death, and I tried not to wonder how awful it must be for my mom to see her dead husband's doppelganger smiling at her from across the breakfast table every morning. Part of me even wondered if that might be why she'd become such a workaholic the past few years. My mom had never played the part of the lonely widow. She went out dancing with her friends all the time, and I knew she dated occasionally, too. But she always seemed to end her relationships before they got serious. I'd never bothered to ask her why. The reason was obvious. She was still in love with my father, or at least with the memory of him. In my younger years, I'd drawn a kind of perverse satisfaction from knowing how much she missed him, because it was proof my parents really had been in love. But now that I'd grown up a little, I was beginning to worry she might stay single forever. I didn't like the idea of her living here all alone in this house after I graduated and moved out. "Hi, Mom," I said, speaking softly so as not to startle her.
"Oh, hey, honey," she said, muting the TV and sitting up slowly. "I didn't hear you come in."
She pointed at her right cheek, and I dutifully went over and planted a kiss there.
"Thank you,"
she said, ruffling my hair. Then she patted the couch beside her, and I sat down, pulling Muffet onto my lap.
"How was your day, kiddo?" she asked.
"Not too bad," I said, punctuating the lie with a casual shrug to help sell it. "How was your day, Ma?"
"Oh, it was pretty good,"
she replied, mimicking my voice and my casual shrug. "Glad to hear it," I said, even though I suspected she was fibbing, too. She spent her days taking care of cancer patients, many of them terminally ill. I wasn't sure how she ever managed to have a good day at that job. "You're not working late tonight?" I asked. "It's a Christmas miracle." She laughed at our old family joke. Everything was a Christmas miracle at our house, all year round.
"I decided to take a night off."
She swung her feet off the couch and turned to face me.
"You hungry, babe? Because I'm craving cinnamon French toast."
She stood up.
"How about it, kid? Feel like having some breakfast for dinner with your mom?"
Her question made my spider sense tingle. My mom only offered to make me breakfast for dinner when she wanted to have a serious talk with me.
"Thanks, but I had pizza at work," I said, inching backward. "I'm kind of stuffed."
She moved between me and the staircase, blocking my escape.
"You shall not pass," she declared, stomping her foot down theatrically on the carpet.
"Your vice principal called me a little while ago," she said. "He told me you ditched math class early today, right after you tried to pick a fight with Douglas Notcher." I looked at her face and fought down a wave of anger, instead forcing myself to see how worried and upset she was and how much she was trying to hide it.
"I wasn't trying to pick a fight, Mom," I said. "He was tormenting this other kid who sits near me. He's been bullying him for weeks. And I ran out of there because it was the only way to stop myself from tearing Notcher's head off. You should be proud of me."
She studied my face for a moment. Then she sighed and kissed me on the cheek.
"Okay, kiddo," she said, hugging me. "I know it isn't easy being stuck in that zoo. Just tough it out for a few more months, and then you'll be free. Captain of your own destiny."
"I know, Ma," I said. 2 months. I'll make it. No worries. Remember, she added, biting her lip, you're not a minor anymore. I know, I said. Don't worry. Nothing like that will ever happen again, okay? She nodded. I could see that she was thinking about the incident. The incident that I just promised her, for the 1,000th time, would never happen again. Here's what would never happen again. One morning, a few weeks after I started 7th grade, I was walking past Notcher and a few of his friends in the hallway, when he smiled at me and said, "Hey, Lightman, is it true your old man was dumb enough to die in a shit factory explosion?" I'm not paraphrasing. That's a direct quote. There were eyewitnesses. The next thing I remember, I was sitting on Notcher's chest, staring down at his motionless, blood-drenched face amid a cacophony of screams from our classmates. Then I felt the tangle of strong arms around my neck and torso pulling me up and off of him, and found myself wondering why my knuckles were in agony and why Notcher was now curled in a bleeding heap on the waxed marble floor in front of me. Afterward, they said I attacked him like a wild animal and beat him unconscious. They said I kept right on beating him, even after he went limp. Apparently, it took two other boys and a teacher to finally pull me off of him. Notcher spent a week in the hospital recovering from a mild concussion and a fractured jaw. I got off pretty light, considering a 2-week suspension and mandatory anger management therapy the remainder of the school year, along with the nickname Zack Attack, and a permanent reputation as the class psycho. Far worse than any of that was the terrible 10-second gap the incident had left in my memory, and the question it had forced me to ask myself nearly every day since. What would I have done if there had been no one there to stop me? Notcher had probably seen a scan of my father's old newspaper obituary online. It was one of the only results that came up when you searched for his name. That was the way I'd learned how he died. My mother and grandparents had kept the details of his death from me while I was growing up, and I'm thankful they did, because that obituary had haunted me since the moment I'd first read it. I still had every word memorized. Beaverton man dies in wastewater treatment plant accident. Beaverton Valley Times, October 6, 2000. A Beaverton man was killed at approximately 9 a.m. Friday in an accident at the city's wastewater treatment plant on South River Road. Dead is Xavier Ulysses Lightman, 19, of 603 Bluebonnet Avenue, an employee of the city of Beaverton. The Washington County coroner pronounced Lightman dead at the scene. Lightman was working near a storage tank when an undetected methane leak rendered him unconscious. Investigators surmised a spark from an exposed electrical circuit ignited the gas, and Lightman was killed instantly in the subsequent explosion. A lifetime resident of Beaverton, Lightman is survived by his wife, Pamela, and son, Zachary. Funeral arrangements. Zach, are you even listening to me right now? Of course I am, Mom, I lied. What were you saying? I said that your guidance counselor, Mr. Russell, left me a voicemail, too. She folded her arms. He said you missed your last two career counseling sessions. Sorry, I must have forgotten, I said. I'll go to the next one, okay? I promise. I tried to slip past her again, but she blocked my path and then stomped her foot down in front of me again, pretending like she was Gandalf and I was the Balrog. Did you finally make a decision? She asked, eyeing me. You mean, did I decide what I want to do with the rest of my life? She nodded. I took a deep breath and said the first thing that came to mind. Well, I have thought about this quite a bit, and after careful consideration, I've decided that I don't want to buy anything, sell anything, or process anything. She frowned and began to shake her head in protest, but I kept going. You know, as a career, I don't want to do that, I went on. I don't want to buy anything sold or processed. I don't want to sell anything bought or processed. Or process anything sold, bought, or processed, she finished, cutting me off. Who do you think you're messing with? Lloyd, Lloyd, all null and void. Busted, I said, raising my hands in a gesture of guilt. That's what you get for making me watch that flick 7 gajillion times. She folded her arms. Zach, there's more than enough money set aside in your college fund to cover 4 years of tuition at most schools. You can go anywhere you want and study anything you want. Do you know how lucky you are? Yep, I was lucky, all right. My mom had started that college fund for me when I was still just a baby, using some of the settlement money from my father's death that was left over after she bought our house. There had been enough to cover her tuition for nursing school, too. Lucky, right? Want to hear another stroke of great luck? My father's corpse was so badly burned in the explosion that the coroner had to use his dental records to identify the body, saving my mom from having to go to the morgue and identify his corpse herself. How much good fortune can one family stand? Did you think over what we discussed last time? She asked. You promised to consider going to college to study how to make video games, like Mike Cruz is planning to do. I'm good at playing video games, Mom, I said, not at making them. You need to be really good at programming or digital art, and I suck at both. I sighed and looked at my feet. The important thing is that you love gaming, she said. You'd figure out the rest. You'd enjoy it. She smiled and touched my face. You know I'm right. You've got gamer geek DNA on both sides. It was true. You'd never know it to look at her, but my mom was a hardcore gamer in her day, too. She'd had a serious World of Warcraft habit for a few years. She was more of a casual gamer now, but she played Terra Firma missions with me sometimes. Aren't there people who get paid to play the video games to test them out? Yeah, they're called quality assurance testers, I said. The job sounds good in theory, but in reality it sucks. The pay is crap, and all you do is play the same level of the same game over and over thousands of times to try and find bugs in the code. That would drive me nuts. She sighed and nodded. Yeah, me too. She lowered her voice to a conspiratorial whisper, then smiled. You know, Zach, she said, you can enroll in college even if you're still not sure what you want to study. You just take a bunch of different courses and see what interests you. You'll figure out what you want to do eventually. I smiled and nodded in agreement, but she still didn't budge. I'm not trying to pressure you, honey, she said. I just want you to have a plan. My plan for right now, I slowly told my mother, is to keep on working at Starbase Ace. Maybe switch from part-time to full-time. That's an after-school job, Zach, not a long-term career plan. Think about what it would be like 5 years from now. Everyone else will be finishing college and starting a career, and you... I'll still be sitting on my ass all day, 5 blocks from where I graduated, working the same crappy retail job I had when I was 16, I finished for her. Exactly. I tried to look hurt. I find your lack of faith disturbing. You're going to find my foot jam disturbingly far up your ass if you don't stop screwing around and start making a serious plan for your future, mister. When you start calling me mister, I know you're being super serious, I said. I'm not saying that you have to go to college, honey. Join a monastery. Join the Peace Corps. Join the fucking X-Men. I don't care what you do, as long as you do something, okay? I pretended to sigh heavily in relief. In that case, maybe I'll run off and join the circus, I said. I could start out as a weight guesser, then maybe work my way up to operating the tilt-a-whirl. I think you might have a few too many teeth for that line of work, smartass, she said, giving me a playful shove.
I'm not trying to give you a hard time, Ace. I just want the best for you. You're so smart and talented, honey. You can do great things. She looked me in the eyes. You know that, right? Yeah, I know, Ma, I said. Try not to worry, okay? She frowned and continued to block my path, arms folded to indicate that getting past her wasn't going to be that easy. But then, like a gift from the gods, my phone chimed to inform me I had a new text message. I fumbled it out of my pocket and studied its display. Urgent reminder, Earth Defense Alliance Command, Lieutenant Lightman, you are ordered to log in for your mission briefing at 8 p.m. PST. I also saw that Cruz and Deal had each sent me multiple text messages asking what the hell had happened in class and if I was still down for our Armada mission. Sorry, Ma, I gotta run, I said, holding up my phone like it was some sort of hall pass. I'm late for my Armada mission. It starts in just a few minutes. Yeah, yeah, she said, rolling her eyes. I know, late for a video game. She stepped out of my way. Go on. Go get him, Maverick. Thanks. I gave her a quick kiss on the cheek, which briefly inverted her frown. Then I grabbed the Armada controller box as I ran up the stairs and then down the hall, eager to reach the safety of my bedroom and the portal to another reality that lay beyond it. But my mother's voice traveled faster than I did, and her final, shouted warning reached my ears before I could clear the neutral zone. It was something I'd heard her say countless times growing up, and usually it made me want to roll my eyes at her. But this time, her words filled me with a genuine sense of dread. I know the future is scary at times, sweetheart, but there's just no escaping it. 5. I locked the door and pressed my back to it. And, with my mother's warning about the inescapable nature of the future still echoing in my ears, I scanned the interior of my room, for the first time feeling a sense of shame over how I'd chosen to decorate it. The posters on my walls, the books and comics and toys on my shelves, nearly all of them had once belonged to my late father. The room couldn't even be classified as a shrine to his memory because I didn't even remember the guy. This was more like a museum exhibit. A really sad, fucked up one, devoted to a man I'd never even known and never would. No wonder my mother avoided coming in here. Seeing the decor probably broke her heart 2 or 3 different ways. A small fleet of model spacecraft hung suspended from the ceiling on fishing line, and as I crossed my room, I brushed each of them with my fingertips, setting them in motion one after the other. First, the Starship Enterprise, then the Sulaco from Aliens, followed by an X-Wing, a Y-Wing, the Millennium Falcon, a Veritech fighter from Robotech, and, finally, a carefully painted Gunstar from The Last Starfighter. I pulled the window shades down, plunging the room into darkness save for a narrow shaft of moonlight that fell on my battered leather gaming chair in the corner, casting it in an otherworldly glow. As I collapsed into the chair, I sang the first 5 bars of Duel of the Fates to myself in anticipation. Dun-dun-da-da-da! I grabbed my dusty game console and disconnected my old plastic flight stick and throttle controllers, along with my bulky first-generation VR headset, which was held together with copious amounts of black electrical tape. Once the old gear was set aside, I connected the various components of my new interceptor flight control system and positioned them around my chair, placing the heavy metal flight stick on an old milk crate in front of me, directly between my knees, with the separate throttle controller on the flat armrest of my chair, within easy reach of my left hand. This setup was supposed to recreate the exact layout of the interceptor cockpit controls seen in the game, my own private starship simulator. Sitting there inside it, I remembered building a spaceship cockpit out of couch pillows in front of the television when I was a kid in an effort to make the experience of playing Star Fox on my Nintendo 64 more realistic. I'd had the idea after seeing some kids do it in an old Atari commercial for Cosmic Arc on one of my father's videotapes.
Once I had my new controllers arranged properly, I synced my phone to the Bluetooth headphones built into my new Armada VR flight helmet. Then, I queued up my Raid the Arcade playlist, my digital recreation of an old analog mixtape I'd found among my father's things with that title carefully printed on its label in my father's handwriting.